Project Censored with Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good morning. Welcome to the Morning Mix. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. It's Friday, December 9th, 2011. Today's program, we'll be speaking with Michael Levitin, one of the founding editors of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, which has had five print editions in New York City. The newest edition is national. It's across the United States and is online at occupiedmedia.us. We'll be talking about how the Occupied movement uses print newspapers, the internet, to build the message. Later in the program, we'll hear from genocide expert Angel Riono regarding the Cambodian genocide and the many similarities to Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll also hear from our friend Steve Zeltzer of Work Week Radio with a local labor calendar. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Abby Martin of Media Roots also is joining us again this morning. Welcome back, Abby. We're going to start the show today by talking with Michael Levitin, one of the founding editors of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, which has five print editions now. The most recent is national. Michael is a longtime journalist. He began in Bolivia. He spent several years in Berlin, attended the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, graduated in 2002. He was also the founding editor of the Prague Literary Review. Michael joins us in studio today to talk about the history of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, where he is involved. And Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Mickey and Peter.
Thank you so much for having us. Thanks so much for joining us here today. Tell us about this. I mean, this is the, literally, we're looking at it. People may actually be able to hear us rustling the papers around. The Occupied Wall Street Journal. I mean, this is a broadsheet, you know. This is tactile. This is something, in the age of the internet, and of course you are on occupiedmedia.us. But this is something you can hold in your hand, and this is something that was very instrumental in the early days of Occupied New York City. Can you talk to us about the beginning of this and how you got involved?
I think that was just, as you said, it tactile and something that you can actually pass person to person, read on the subways, read in the parks, read on the street. Really important. And I think the urgency that people felt in the first days and weeks, it was really the second week that we started to put this paper out. The idea came from some arts and culture minded people who said, let's do something that's creative, that reflects this movement and really tells the voices and shows the faces of this movement. The media, mainstream media, as we call it, was not going to do that job for the movement. Everybody knew that, so we had to have a media of our own.
Right, and of course the corporate, we call it the corporate mainstream media, Project Censored, because we're the mainstream, not the 1%, and the corporate media is the mouthpiece for the 1%. And this paper, then, you know, it's not just a compilation of really profound thinkers and so forth. I mean, you have a lot of, you know, Barbara Kingsolver and Slavoj Žižek, and there's a lot of people in here, but there's also a lot of voices of the people, just regular people on the ground, and it's a wonderful compilation in occupiedmedia.us. Can you talk about how you might, how do you put this together? How did you put together the first issues?
That was really the idea. I think we really needed to get this sense that the people on the ground, the people who were starting this occupation, who were going to grow this movement, this wasn't like a preaching to the converted kind of thing, like let's all write for our own kind of internal, you know, pamphlet or newsletter. This was an outreach. This was a way to reach and grow the movement. Everybody in the early days was thinking, how do we expand this and bring in more people? So to write something that brings it in kind of sober, clear language, really what what the issues are, talking on message, economic inequality and corporate greed and wealth disparity, basic messages, how to express that.
You've been a media activist for a long time. Michael's a Project Censored Award winner from 1994, article on clear-cutting from your high school newspaper at the time, and you've been all over the world. And what was amazing to me about this broadsheet, Occupied Wall Street Journal, is that you were able to get 50,000 copies out, and that the movement itself, even in New York, widely distributed these. So you had no mechanisms of distribution. Tell us how that worked.
It was pretty amazing, really, and it showed, I think, the hunger that people feel, and especially for something print, as retro as that seems, with everything new media going on. It's like we put out a proposal online on Kickstarter asking for 12 grand. We figured we could get 3 or 4 issues out. We got within a week $75,000, and we just put it to use. And that meant, you know, each print run of 50,000 copies costs around $400 to $4,500. We would print 100,000 then. When they would go out on the street and be snapped up within a couple of days, we just ran more. And it allowed us to do run after run. We printed a folio graphics issue, which cost a bit more, but we had the money to do that. And now this national issue, which is going out in Houston, in the Bay Area, in Chicago, different cities, that is the purpose. That's what people donated for. And that's what we tried to do. And this notion of reaching both the bigger think pieces, as Mickey says, and also really getting the voices from the movement itself. We're trying to tell this story as clearly and create a narrative as clear as possible.
Michael, this is Abby from Media Roots. It's great to see the website and then to see a physical copy of this because it's so wonderfully put together. And I like that it doesn't only just cover the occupied movement internationally, but it also covers, like you said, issues about why we're occupying. Is this a collaborative process where you pull in different editors and writers? How does that work where you pull in these stories?
It's a really small kind of team of people. And also what's interesting is that we kind of veered away, and I think we were one of the early groups that were now called affinity groups is what people are calling them. But at the moment that we created this, we didn't exactly think of ourselves an affinity group. Many things have to go through consensus and be discussed in the General Assembly. We kind of wanted to be slightly outside of that process, so we had editorial control, and we managed to do that so that we could kind of have an efficient, directed publication that didn't need hundreds of people to approve every time we wanted to print something. And I think that the editorial process, we run pretty democratically. We're a group of 5 editors, and new editors come on with every publication. There were 2 of us, then there were 3 and 4 and 5. Contributors come from all over. People have submitted from all around, from Europe. We get submissions coming in now from Italy and Spain. So we are trying to grab in from the greatest pool of people possible.
Yeah, speaking of that, I mean, the front page of this, the new edition, the national edition that you're saying, right? You have a quote from the European philosopher Zizek, and it's interesting. Well, day after John Lennon's 31st anniversary of John Lennon on Imagine, right? It says here, they tell you we are dreamers, and Zizek says, the true dreamers are those who think things can go on indefinitely the way they are. We are not dreamers. We are awakening from a dream which is turning into a nightmare. We are not destroying anything. We are only witnessing how the system is destroying itself. To be engaged in fighting for freedom, you have to first free yourself from the chains of ruling ideology. When you criticize capitalism, don't allow yourself to be blackmailed that you are against democracy. The change is possible. So talk about that really, you know, the corporate media says, what do they want? What are the demands? There's demands. And you say in the paper, there is no list of demands. So can you talk about some of those principles, some of these ideas, and what that means?
I think from the beginning, I think Zizek has been saying these things for years, and it strikes maybe American readers more as something more radical than many are prepared to think or discuss publicly, that capitalism, he ends this, and we actually cut out a quote that he ended it with, the marriage between democracy and capitalism is over, he said. Part of our paper was trying to make a sober reflection of things and not to dissuade or sort of turn some people off who don't want to see that this is an anti-capitalist, and it isn't an anti-capitalist moment. It is against many notions that sort of our modern version of capitalism seems to stand for. It's about curtailing and putting limits on that capitalism. The notion of demands, I think that was a key moment in the movement early on when sort of it was collectively, it wasn't even decided, it was simply known sort of that there weren't going to be these demands, that what leaders and politicians and media people want is for us to be talking to them and asking them sort of for permission to be carrying out some kind of movement or protest. We're saying that this is not a protest. This is not a protest. A protest, you show up and then you go home. This is an occupation and it's participation. And we're not talking to them. And that was something that I think was hard to get through, we're simply not talking to the politicians. We're not talking to the media. We're talking to each other, right? That was the feeling that galvanized this moment from the start. It's like people coming out and simply participating and realizing that that's your only obligation to take part in this moment. The only thing really you need to do is participate in whatever way that means. And now we're seeing it sprout out in hundreds and in literally thousands of places and in forms across the country in whatever way people decide that participation means. And it will evolve and, I think, bloom as we see the year ahead coming on quick.
This is very similar to the 15 May movement in Spain, where people gathered in the plazas and simply talked. And the media was trying to figure out, well, what do they want? What are they doing? Well, who are they siding for politically? And it's not about that. It's really about engaging in an open democratic discussion of what the issues are. Now, this broadsheet that's coming out, the next one is going to be national. So are you printing in different places, and you're going to be distributing this weekend in Oakland and other places? Tell us how that's going to work.
We are, but what I'm already seeing here out west, now that I've come out west and come back to see family and people on the west coast, I'm looking at Oakland. They've already got the occupied Oakland Trib. I'm going to be talking tomorrow to occupiers up in Santa Rosa and Sebastopol who want to start their own paper. I think that the beauty of this is that everyone wants to take an ownership, become a stakeholder in this movement, right? And it's really an easy thing to do because it just means getting involved. I think making newspapers on a smaller scale, local scale, for communities, and, you know, Oakland Trib's a great example. They don't necessarily need this Occupied Wall Street Journal at the Oakland port shutdowns. They're going to have their own. But yes, we will be distributing that. I think we're running 50,000 copies this weekend here.
Michael, I liked what you said about, you know, the politicians are expecting us to have demands, and they're trying to control the message. And that's why this zine is so important. And that's why, especially in places where people take public transportation in big cities and everyone's reading on the subway, and it's just a crucial element to the movement. I just applaud you for taking the initiative and really helping pioneer this.
Thanks a lot.
We're speaking with Michael Levitin, one of the founding editors and managers of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. And even though you do keep hearing us repeatedly talking about, you know, the wonderful tactile physical version and copy of the paper that this is, but it is also available online. You can find out more information at occupiedmedia.us. And at Project Censored, well, we've sort of been occupying media for 35 years. We're kind of occupying free speech radio here now for almost a year on Friday mornings. And you know, I think that one of the points that you bring up, Michael, that's very important as far as the 99% and this kind of a broadsheet for the 99% is that it defies the institutional narcissism of our culture, and it's not pretentious, it's not ego driven or personality driven, it's not based on a list of demands, it defies historical framing of social movements, and I think that's something that is organically growing, and I think that and Peter and I have been talking about this for some time. The corporate media is irrelevant. It's a distraction machine. It's a top-down managed news propagandistic type structure, and this is bottom up. So it's very different.
And I think just to add to that, looking ahead to the year that we're going to encounter, 2012, I think it's building to be quite a year, as most people would see it, and to make sense of how quickly and how sort of dramatically we are shifting this dialogue in America, how it's happened this instantly and following everything we've seen in the Arab world this year, in the Mediterranean, you know, and now in Latin America. I mean, it is a global dialogue happening. It is a global conversation of people, not leaders, but people across the world talking to each other. And, to try to make sense of that with languages.
What we've seen and what we're talking about right now is the agreements to protect the euro, top-down austerity measures, central banks controlling government spending, putting limits on borrowing. I mean, all of that impacts people on a daily basis, and it's that frustration with the inability to advance, if you're a working class person, to see any improvement in your life over the last 40 years, in fact in many cases see a decline, that is so prevalent in the culture, and people haven't known really what to do about it. But the idea that there's 1% of a global population that dominates what our lives are is starting to really emerge, and it's a message that permeates, and it's a really large. Everybody has issues, and there's a lot of different issues. My students sat down in an hour, discussed, and laid out what they considered were some of the most important issues. We need to tax the rich, protect Social Security, protect local jobs, have health care for all, affordable higher education, independence on oil, no private military, full transparency of government. And they just did this somewhat randomly in a process where they listed a lot and then voted on them. This can happen anywhere, and it seems to be happening in the street. And that's without specifically saying this is what we demand.
And this notion of the street, of people taking to the streets, and we were talking about this earlier, Mickey, about when thousands of people marched in Berkeley and just that feeling. I think when even a couple hundred people get together, not to mention thousands, this idea of occupying the streets, whose streets, our streets, the sense that we are simply participating nonviolently, peacefully, and that authority doesn't know what to do with this movement, which is why they have lashed out. They have shown their fear, mayors and governments across the country, really, and whether they challenge the legality of actually setting up tents and encampments and squares, or simply are not able to comprehend when large groups of people, entirely peacefully, having dialogue, gather in a public space and march in a public space. This sense, it's like a rupture and something, a real dialogue, I think, in America has to start about where authority, where law and order sort of intersect and where there are different things that our authority should be focusing on.
We're speaking with Michael Levitin, one of the founding editors of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. And that, again, I love the name. You know, and this movement is really rich with creativity. And I think that's a really important component of this and this discussion and this kind of a dialogue is that it is integrative, it is inclusive, and also it's also about a reclamation of the commons. You know, we've talked about the commons on this program for the better part of a year. The fair share of the common heritage is something that we've been working on at Project Censored, and this really is about the commons. This is about everybody, and well, everybody that is wanting to be part of the communal global culture, not the 1% that rapaciously exploits the 99%.
Although the doors are open to all 1%ers who decide to want to be 99.
Yeah. Well, Michael, you're also out here for the 12-12-11, the Occupy Strikes Back Coordinated West Coast Port Blockade, this coming Monday, December 12th. There's a rally at 3 p.m. at 14th and Broadway in Oakland, California. 4 p.m. march to the port from Oscar Grant Plaza, 5 p.m. West Oakland BART, 5:30 a.m. in fact, there's a West Oakland BART that marches. That's 5:30 a.m. on 12-12-11. Can you talk to us about what's going on with that and your involvement?
Well, I think, Abby, you're probably more qualified. You're the local on the ground, Occupy Oakland, and reporting. You might do better, actually. I know that I'm going to be there and I'm going to be taking part. But
absolutely, so will I. And I encourage everyone, if they can't make it at any of those times, just come out whenever you can. We'll be there all day, and it's going to be really exciting to see what happens.
I think this idea of doing it in waves, of having the early waves, see what happens in the morning if things are going well, and then having this rally and marching in the afternoon and evening. And really, when these things get started, we've seen it in New York, we've seen it in Oakland and elsewhere. These are marathons. These things, you know, you can go into a 48-hour stretch where people are basically, you know, when Zuccotti got closed down, that's it. And then people marched with 40,000 people across the Brooklyn Bridge the next day. It's like these are kind of monumental days into nights into days. And this blockade is really taking the movement to another level, it seems, across the West Coast.
Absolutely. I mean, civil disobedience, we kind of, it's a great statement to make. I wanted to ask you, Michael, do you think, have you heard of the new provision in the DOD bill that turns the U.S. into a battleground and now gives, the Senate overwhelmingly voted to pass this bill, and I was just wondering what your thoughts were. Do you think that it's, in the face of these federalized crackdowns coordinated nationwide against the Occupy Wall Street movement, it's just interesting that we see this draconian piece of legislation kind of quietly ushered into the new defense bill.
interesting would be a good word to use. I find it, I think that our politicians are so, I don't know whether clueless is the right word, but they're so, their hands are tied. They're in the old order, and to the notion of a popular, massive sort of uprising of people with values and true, the facts in their hands, the numbers. People have been getting simply screwed for far too long. And for those in power to sort of not yet be hearing that, or to be, they're behind the curve, and to react with sort of draconian measures, like you say, doesn't send the right message, since those folks are quite literally on their way out, in a way. I mean, we will be using the legislative process to vote in people we feel can represent the needs and interests of the 99%. So those who, you know, are sort of pushing back against it, like the whole current Republican administration, I mean, to still refuse to acknowledge that the wealthy and the wealthiest Wall Street financial institutions should pay their taxes, is just to go absolutely against the wave of sentiment right now in the country.
So I'm glad that you said Republican administration, by the way.
I would say they're both pretty responsible, but yes, clearly Republicans have gummed up the works.
And Obama's gotten more money than Banks and any other candidate combined for the 2012 race, so he's definitely not an ally to Occupy Wall Street. But
no.
It seems to me that part of what we're saying here, part of what Occupy is saying, is that these are public places. Ports are subsidized by public taxes, and these are places where that the public and large numbers can go and participate and speak out, and if it interferes with the workday, so be it, because these are our streets, our places, and in a very big way, we're claiming that, and I think that's an important part. We're almost out of time here, Michael. Where are we going? Where is this going to evolve to?
That's a nice question. It makes me warm thinking about it, thinking of the year ahead. I think I think a lot of people need a little bit of a break from the intensity. I think we're seeing that there's a nice lull, not here on Monday for sure. This blockade is hardly called a break, but I think that in general this winter sort of retraction time, and it's like a big hit and then withdrawing a bit, really getting ready for the spring. I think reaching out to the 99% at large and the public, expanding this, growing this, conveying what this movement is about and bringing people in is going to be the emphasis. And I think this spring we're going to see something special.
We've been speaking with Michael Levitin of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. It's online at occupiedmedia.us. Michael, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for your work. We're certainly going to be hearing more from you in the weeks and months to come.
Appreciate it a lot.
You can learn more about the West Coast port blockade at westcoastportshutdown.org. We'll be back in a few minutes with Angel Riono talking about the Cambodian genocide and the connections to Iraq and Afghanistan.
State your name. The first one's sacred, the rest profane. Speak and make lightning, and then confess. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Shards of bone scattered across the clearing. The fear she had were well worth fearing.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on the Morning Mix, KPFA Free Speech Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips and Abby Martin of Media Roots. The next part of the show, we're going to be speaking about a really heavy topic about the Cambodian genocide and talking about similarities to Iraq and Afghanistan with our next guest. And Peter, you can introduce.
Angel Rignono is a graduate of Saybrook University, and which is located in San Francisco. She did her MA research on local and grassroots capacities for reconciliation and peace, focusing on Cambodia. She's also done two chapters this year, Evolution of Peace, a Step Toward Reconciliation, Understanding Healing in the Post-Genocidal Rwanda, which is an edited anthology, Peace Movements Worldwide. She also has authored a chapter exploring the role of apology in the Cambodian post-genocide reconciliation process. Angel works at the War Crimes Study Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Angel, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We want to talk about the Cambodian genocide and the definitions of kind of genocide in general, and partly about the U.S. NATO global empire and how genocides continue to happen and what that means. So let's start with that. What's a good definition of genocide?
So the definition of genocide can be discussed through law. So it's just like a typical crime. You have the intention and then you have that physical act. So the definition of genocide is that there should be intention, a planned willingness to target and to destroy a part or a whole of an ethnic group, a religious group, or a political group. And then genocide also means that you actually take the take actions to actually carry out those intentions. So that would be the legal definition. Now, if there are other kinds of laws, such as war crime laws and humanitarian laws, that cover other kinds of wanton destruction of civilians. So,
well, tell us about Cambodia then, historically, and the U.S. involvement there.
Okay, so some of the key things that happened was that Cambodia was actually transitioning out of many years of French colonial rule, and also during World War II, Japan's occupation, and it was moving into becoming its own state. And what happened was that Sihanouk, who was a prince who then became the prime minister, had made expressly stated to the world that they wanted to stay neutral in the Vietnamese War. But the United States involvement in the Cambodian internal conflict happened when the U.S. government backed the prime minister's deputy prime minister, Long Nol, and helped to depose Sihanouk, and also supported Long Nol's military campaign to fight Vietnam on the Cambodian side. So that was sort of the entry of the United States into what was happening in Cambodia. In Cambodia, even during Sihanouk's rule, there were still a lot of armed factions fighting sort of rebel groups fighting wars in other parts of Cambodia. And so then the Khmer Rouge was a communist-based group, and they, during all of this, you know, warfare happening, had basically dominated one part of Cambodia, and when the United States left Cambodia, they were able to take over. And that's essentially 1975 was when they took over, and for about 4 years, they ruled the government, they ruled the country, and they caused, you know, millions and millions of people to die.
Yeah. Right, well, the United States is responsible for millions of deaths in Vietnam as it
yes.
was already.
Yes.
You know, so we're looking at, you know, 5-6 million people just right here.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And then you have about 7 million in Cambodia, and also between there was a 9-year period before the Cambodian genocide where the United States was involved in aerial bombing of both Laos and Cambodia, and that, I think the records were just more recently released because Bill Clinton actually released classified documents, and now they're doing research, and Ben Carolyn and Taylor Owen have been collecting and consolidating the information to show that these bombings are equivalent to more than the World War II bombings.
So that really puts it, again, into more historical context, and it's always important. I mean, I guess I'm biased. I'm an historian. but I think the background is very important in understanding how these things happened in the first place. And I mean, this really is almost a censored history.
Yes.
really, I mean, not to you, of course, and not the people that study it and read it, but these things are just woefully underreported. And that process of the lack of understanding and the lack of reporting about these types of issues pave the way for the continuation of these things in many, many parts of the world.
Absolutely. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was that when the U.S. is engaged in warfare in another part of the world, on the ground in the United States, it's typically the story is spun so that, you know, the enemy that's, you know, abroad becomes the enemy that is the sole enemy of the United States. And so then the public narrowly sees the story of war as, you know, enemies trying to attack the United States. And then that drives up negative emotions, and people, the public, U.S. public, stops asking questions about what's going on over there.
There's this reckless dehumanization process. I mean, the Cambodians, people in Laos, Vietnam, they pose no threat to the people of the United States.
No, there was no threat, and because of a precedence of neutrality and an intent to become an independent state and to stay far away from conflict, at least in the Cambodian case, what the United States was getting, what the Americans were getting, was the story that communism was going to fall like dominoes down from Soviet Union to China and down all the way through Southeast Asia. But that wasn't what was going on in Southeast Asia at all.
No, and it was an interesting game of dominoes. I've never played dominoes where dominoes at opposite sides of the table would somehow be responsible for the falling of other dominoes at other sides of the table. But the whole Cold War domino theory is a slippery slope fallacy. But, I mean, again, we saw that same kind of a thing with weapons of mass destruction. Absolutely. The same kind of... Let's bring this up to the present a little bit anyway. We're speaking with Angel Riono about the Cambodian genocide. Again, absolute tragic history. You could say it's forgotten, but that would assume people knew it in the first place. On one hand, let's bring this up to the present and then talk about the suppression of that information and why it's important for the imperial 1%, right, to suppress that history. What's going on right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, right, with the lies that pave the way into this war, into these occupations, over a million dead Iraqis.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
And the AP and others, they still report the numbers at 87,000 and so forth. Lies. All lies repeatedly.
Well, we're moving into a phase where, you know, the United States is sort of starting to pull out. And you're starting to see the effects of many, many years of war and abusive governments in Iraq. And so what you're essentially seeing is sort of the outcomes of war, and that is never going to be reported, at least. But connecting Cambodia to Iraq and Afghanistan, I'd like to say that, like, in many cases, they are similar in that the United States has influenced the election process or the political process, which is in total opposition to democracy. And when you don't have real democracy, you don't have a stable government. And in all three cases, there have been historical divisions, armed violence, and abuse committed by political leaders. And so, therefore, the United States coming in with more violence basically makes it more complicated and exacerbates the problem.
The United States has a long history of doing this.
Yeah.
And Cambodia is certainly one case. Part of the occupied movement has included a number of people from various groups and diversity across the country, including Native Americans, who experienced a genocide here in the United States. And so we have this history that evolves even up to the present. So part of Occupy, part of an educational process there, is recognizing that the imperial wars of the 1% are in fact genocidal in many cases, and deliberate, and I think that's what you're saying.
Well, yes, and then the amount of money that the government spends on defense is one of the top three of our biggest and most expensive items on the national budget, and why we continue to spend that much money, I don't understand sometimes.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's understandable that you don't understand, given that you're not thinking from the 1% mindset of imperialism.
Yes.
It defies any kind of principles related to human compassion, rights, the idea of human equality, liberty, these kinds of things. We're talking about rampant exploitation.
Right. Well, the thing is that the American public is convinced that there's always this imminent danger, that, you know, that we have enemies all over the place, and that, you know, that our security is always threatened. But that's not really true. I mean, these wars and these conflicts are happening always abroad, and they're usually between groups within a community. They're not targeted at us. Most I'm talking about statistically, and yet we spend so much money getting involved, and also making things a lot more complicated, and actually bringing more weapons and more destruction to these areas.
And as Peter said, there's a long history of that. I mean, you know, we could go back to Columbus and the Arawaks and so forth. I mean, 98.5% decimation of the indigenous population of the Americas as a result of European colonialism. And that model really has continued. And your focus, of course, is how this is happening in Southeast Asia. But now, also in the Middle East, and we mentioned Iraq before, and Afghanistan. You also contributed to the Peace Movements Worldwide trilogy. Mark Pilisook and Michael Nagler, Peter Phillips, and I also contributed to that. When we, in fact, we met at the wonderful conference that we had in Berkeley not long ago. Could you talk a little bit about your contributions there, and also a little bit about what? There are often trials, or there's often sort of a calling to account, maybe historically, of people that were that are responsible for these types of massive crimes against humanity. Could you talk about that?
Oh yes. Well, that gets into international criminal law, and I can tell you one thing is that although the United States generally supports universal human rights, the concept of that, and especially very involved in collective cooperations for security, what the United States government has historically done is play the other side of the fence as well, is heavily in opposition to institutions like the International Criminal Court and or any kind of projects and programs to enforce human rights law and humanitarian law and the protection of civilians. So George W. Bush, for example, opposed the ratification of the Rome Statute and the establishment of the International Criminal Court. And in history, the United States has always tried to circumvent the limits of war, which means things like always opposing laws that would ban weapons that would cause a lot of loss of civilian lives, like landmines, for example, the production and the use of landmines. So the playing of both sides of the fence really makes things very difficult in terms of holding, because the United States is one of the biggest countries and it's actually the most active in war making, and yet it opposes these group treaties to try to hold governments and leaders accountable for their abuses.
So, Angel, if there's an occupation of the port on Monday and you were participating, would you be participating in in opposition to genocide? Do you think that that's part of what Occupy should be doing and creating a conversations about that?
Yes, I think if I were to participate in the Occupy movement actively, I would be very much representing the non-use of the ceasing of using of violence all over the world. I think that money and those resources can be used towards a lot of the problems that the Occupy movement is concerned about.
Yeah, This is Abby, by the way. I think it's really interesting because I think everyone across the entire globe that's participating in the Occupy Wall Street movement can agree that the incessant growth of the military needs to end, and the U.S. imperialism and ending the wars, I think, should be. I mean, if we're going to have a list of demands, I would say that's the first one.
Yeah, I have some suggestions for Occupy activists and just general public. First of all, like, read and talk about each foreign relations issue, especially people who actually are from there or have connections there, and then press the Congress. The congressional representatives have a lot of power in changing the course of war and our military spending. And so definitely writing to your Congress or, you know, getting around the issue of convincing Congress to do so. And then while WikiLeaks is doing a really amazing job in classified and making classified information public, it's worthwhile for us to press the United States government to formally release classified documents so we can really understand what was happening before and how to prevent it in the future. And then just working on, you know, changing the national budget that would, you know, shift the spending away from war making and towards other public services.
Absolutely. Right.
Well, we're certainly spending over half of the discretionary budget on destruction.
Yes, and it's nearly $1 trillion, and then that's not including about $50-plus billion in black budget.
And it's not counting, of course, you know, the trillions on the war and the money that we're, again, borrowing into the future. So we've been speaking with Angel Riono about the Cambodian genocide, the history, basically, of genocide and connecting it to the present. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Our first guest was Michael Levitin, one of the founding editors of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. Again, Angel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips and Abby Martin of Media Roots. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us, and also like to give a big shout out to my friend, colleague, and partner, Dr. Peter Phillips. Today is his birthday. Happy birthday, Peter.
You weren't supposed to say that.
I know. Thanks to Kirsten Thomas. Thanks to Anthony Fest. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We'll see you next week with Diane Ravitch. Take care.